From the Film Gronk Studios in beautiful downtown Studio City, this is Film Gronk. Our commentary today is for Escape from the Planet of the Apes, the third in the Planet of the Apes series. My name is Serge Delpierre, and today we have also here
Tim McMillan
and
Heidi Hilliker.
Our cue point for today is, okay, it's a 70s film and is a Planet of the Apes film, so that means it's the very first frame of the film. Yes, so when you pop the DVD in and it starts fading up, just you pause it there and then inch it back to the very first frame.
There's no logo?
There is no logo, Tim. Not in films from later. Actually, maybe that started with like Star Wars in the late 70s, I think. But here, they just start off cold. Very interesting. So while you're doing that, we're going to discuss why there is no logo on the front of films and first times of seeing Escape from the Planet of the Apes. And then once we're ready to go, I will count down 3, 2, 1, play. And then hopefully you'll do the same thing. And then you will have us in sync while you're watching the movie. And so you can hear our wonderful, colorful commentary. Or you can listen to us while you're doing other things like washing the dishes or running away with the zoo or...
running away with the zoo.
Well, that's what happens at the end of the film. or escaping from the Planet of the Apes or something like that. So, Heidi, when's the first time you saw Escape from the Planet of the Apes?
Well, as we discussed when we did the Beneath the Planet of the Apes commentary, I saw the four sequels to Planet of the Apes at the same time I saw them in a marathon that I think was on Turner Classic Movies. I'm pretty sure it was Turner Classic Movies. It was one of those type channels. So I'd seen Planet of the Apes several times, really enjoyed it. Saw the marathon, decided to watch all the movies in one day.
And a great time was had by all.
It was a great day. It was a great day. I love you, TV.
And what was your impression of seeing it right after having seen Beneath and having seen the planet blow up and going, like, how could they possibly continue this series? Because you didn't know anything about it, did you? Or did you already kind of know about the films and their stories?
Well, I was very familiar with the first one.
Yeah.
I just saw the second one. And, like, I'm around 12 now at the time that I was seeing this, you know. So I can only, like, backtrack my thoughts so much. But but I knew that they were going to show them all day. So, right. Like, I mean, right away they were, like, all day marathon, 5 movies. So, I mean.
But you didn't know what was going to happen, just that something was going to happen.
Right, something was going to happen. Okay. There was going to be another movie.
So how'd that twist hit you that first time you saw that oh, that's how they're going to continue the film?
It just seemed to make a lot of sense, actually. It was like, all right, okay, we're in modern day. This is, I don't know, I went right with it, you
okay,
know?
I'm just curious,
I never had a hard time swallowing that, you know, like that just, they told me that's what happened. I believed them.
as truly all I think good science fiction should do, it should get you to believe just enough of the science and not have to worry about how much the science works,
right?
And then that way you can just keep on going with it.
If it's sugar-coated with this much entertainment, I'll swallow anything,
right?
I mean, you know, they did their homework into as far as what would be entertaining above all else. And I think I saw this when I was about 12. And I remember I liked it so much more than Beneath the Planet of the Apes because, well, for the most part, it was tongue-in-cheek satire. But, of course, the ending depressed the hell out of me.
With the ending of Beneath,
this one.
Beneath or Escape or Planet.
Both.
Or,
but I mean,
or Conquest.
All,
or
all,
yeah,
all.
The endings of these movies really just, you know, throw a wrench in the works, don't they?
Yeah, these endings.
But the ending to Escape was very... My mother had a hard time with me watching this movie because she knew it would upset me. And I'm like, oh, it's a great movie. It's a fun movie. And then at the end, I was
not
a basket
so
case.
So.
Oh, what you put your mother through? I'm sorry.
Yeah, well,
that's okay. But you saw them all on TV, right?
Yes, I did. I've never seen this in the theater.
Have you watched them on DVD? And
I've watched them on Blu-ray. Which is so much closer.
It's not DVD. It's Blu-ray. Yeah.
Blu-ray. I saw this in the movie theater back in 1971. After having seen Beneath the Planet of the Apes the previous year, and that Beneath the Planet of the Apes was in my Ape Chronology was the first film I saw, and then I saw the prequel, as you like to say, Tim, Planet of the Apes.
That's right.
And then, honestly, I'm trying to remember. I don't know if I saw Planet of the Apes before or after Escape. I think I saw it after, because I think Planet of the Apes came on TV in 1972, when this came out in 71. So I'm just going to go ahead and say I hadn't seen Planet of the Apes yet. So Planet of the Apes itself was a big mystery. There was no videotape. It wasn't running in any second run theaters or anything. I just knew about it, knew little bits from, I don't know, from reading comics and reading magazines, like, oh, this scene happened and that scene happened. Ooh, how interesting. But all I had in the context was Beneath. So Beneath ends, and that was my Planet of the Apes universe. And then Escape, found out that Escape from the Planet of the Apes was in the theaters. Ooh, we have to go see it. So, of course, we went to see it, and then we got what we got, which was this, and, of course, a very dark ending.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, I was 10 years old, and it was turning out, I think, if you read up on Planet of the Apes, that, you know, kids were the key demo in A Strange Reef. Kids loved ape films, and that's what they discovered. They didn't even expect it. Now, the good thing, and to be respected, is they never made them for kids. They made them for adults, which was really cool. And that just shows, I mean, honestly, that kids...
Probably why kids liked them.
Kids can take adult content.
Right.
It's supposed to get dumbed down and youthified for you, so it speaks to you. No, just talk, and then maybe someone will listen.
I also think that you grow into the films. I mean, first off, kids watching these traumatic endings, give me a break. I'm sure there's some residue in grown-up adults from the first time they're exposed to the endings of Planet of the Apes movies.
I don't know. I mean, I turned out okay.
I feel like I turned out okay. I mean, we all know what kind of movies I watched when I was little. If you listen to
Clockwork Orange. Oh, my God.
But you grow into them because I think as a kid, you just like the idea of apes being like humans and certain levels. But then as you grow older, you see the social commentaries and you see the extent of the statements that are being made in the writing, and you grow into the maturity of the ideas that are being presented in them. Or did you feel that from the get-go? Or did you just like the...
I kind of felt it from the get-go. Because I saw these movies when I was pretty young, all of them. And I think, I mean, I obviously probably didn't see every detail, you know, that I would now as an adult. They're much more complicated. Mm-hmm. But I got a lot of like the social implications.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Beneath at 9. I saw Escape at 10. You know, I mean, at 10 years old, I was reading The Andromeda Strain. Yeah. And I was reading adult science fiction.
As compared to just, oh, it's an adventure film. Well, look, they're being chased. Oh, look, there's people with guns. There's apes with guns. It's an adventure film.
I got the ideas.
Well, I think it also felt like an adventure film.
Oh, it has definitely.
For sure.
Well, yeah.
But
I think it was the way it captured the imagination somehow.
Yeah.
But I'm not quite sure what that is. But
you know what I think why kids like it? And not to get too off topic or anything like that, but what little kid doesn't like the idea of evolution, you know, like when we were kids, like we were, I mean, I'm sure there's some, but like, you know, but when I was a little kid, I used to want to be a paleontologist, you know, like I was really into dinosaurs, and kids are really into things like that, you know, mm-hmm. dinosaurs, you know, that kind of like nature, that science kind of history, you know, collecting bugs and, you know, microscopes. And I think
impressive creatures. I mean,
right. Yeah. Impressive sharks, you know, mm-hmm. and things like that. Like kids are really into that. This big, exciting world around us. And I think this whole thing of like apes and they're like people and they, you know, they've evolved into that. Like that's something that really does just spark the imagination of children.
Right. And I think you hit on it. Exactly. It's that leap. It's like for me, it wasn't animals of any sort. It was space. I was big into space.
Right, yeah, because kids are in the space. You know, that's another one of those things.
Yeah, and then the ape films came along, and then I became interested in science fiction, post-apocalyptic, that kind of thing, which this fed into. And, of course, now this was like... Well, actually, what I think what made this interesting, too, or makes it interesting, I don't know if it was as a kid, but it essentially kind of reset the story, but you knew where the story was going to end thousands of years from now.
Right, yeah.
Which is
interesting.
So it's like, you're going, it's a sequel, but it's a prequel. Well, it's not a prequel, it's going back in time. So it's all, you know where it's heading. And, you know, there's no, there's one timeline. It's not like there's several timelines. This is where it's going to head, so.
Can we head there?
Let's go. Okay.
Okay.
I was going to mention something about after the films and actually after the TV series, there was a Marvel put out like a big comic, not a small comic, but a big black and white one, which they did explore more of like the future history. They kind of, it was 500 years previous to what happened in the films, which I'm going to touch actually just on chronology. Hmm. This is going to come up later when we get to Battle for the Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
But the first film is supposed to happen in 3975. That's what the meter says.
In the ship.
Mm-hmm. In this film, actually, this is where it comes up. In this film, they say, in Escape from the Planet of the Apes, they say, actually, it was 3955. So they start kind of messing with the canon of what the time
right.
is. And then in the battle, I think it gets a little fluky again. So I just wanted to mention that.
Interesting. I wonder why they would do that.
Could they be a purist? I think they just kind of lost track. I don't know. It's kind of weird.
Because it doesn't seem like there
would to me as a kid, I was just like, wait a minute. You guys, you messed it all up. It's there. You know, it's not like you have to go very far to find out what it is.
But if you said Paul D-E-H-N, Den, Dean.
Dean, yeah.
If he was overseeing it, I would think there'd be better continuity than that.
I don't know. Yeah, anyway. I don't know. It was just a picky point that I had because I was big into space and time and science and canon and writing. So, okay. All right. So now we're going to start the film. Please, ladies and gentlemen, pick up your remotes. And, okay, going to count down now. 3, 2, 1, play. Hey, look, it's a beach.
Which is the way Beneath the Planet of the Apes started.
I think we're in the future. That's what I think right now. What do you think?
If only we had a landmark, something to go by to
something,
know what
something
time
to tell
frame
you what's going
it was.
On. I don't know. Something.
Please, give us a sign.
I like the font.
Yes, again, I still do like that font.
And there's our sign.
It's a helicopter. It must be modern day.
Now, may I say, I just love this opening. I love this beginning. I think it's a great way to kick off excitement for another film of the Ape series.
Yep. And right away, you have a million questions. Helicopter, what? Where are we? Mm-hmm. Spaceship, it's in the water. What's going on? It's true, though.
And it's like being inside Heidi's mind.
And you also have, you have, just coming up, you have spaceship, you have soldiers, you have jeeps, you have guns, all that kind of stuff, which is cool for a little boy of 10 years old, okay.
or a girl.
Girls like jeeps and guns and military and stuff.
Yes, girls like stuff like that.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Wow.
Really.
Okay.
Sometimes boys play with dolls too. So.
Oh, okay.
I had a G.I. Joe.
Doll.
Oh,
it's a doll.
That's James B. Seeking or Psyching. He was on Hill Street Blues, and also I think you mentioned Capricorn One.
He did a very small part in that. I don't think he spoke. He was just a control operator.
That's a
nice
cool
shot.
That is actually some really good second unit helicopter photography. Yeah. And now you got the jeeps on the beach, and you got the soldiers, and
so you had official. You had a shot of the helicopter from a helicopter, and now you see
nice.
The two helicopters that they used for that shot.
Oh, very good. I like that. Yeah, but it's a very exciting sequence when you a space capsule and it's well shot. We're in 2-3-5. Nice transfer.
Oh, they're swimming over. It's so exciting.
And you just know by that spaceship design, and if you've seen the first two movies, I can imagine going to the theater in 1971 and seeing this beginning and seeing this ship, that iconic ship design, you're like, oh my gosh, so excited.
I was very
What's
excited.
Gonna I was What's going to happen? What's going to go on? Because you equate it to the first two movies, you know?
Because I knew in a second they were going to have the music by Rachel Portman.
Yes. Who has scored every Hollywood motion picture since 1937.
According to Serge.
Yeah.
That's because I like Rachel Portman, that's why. And I'm not kidding.
She does good stuff.
She does. She's excellent stuff. No, Jerry Goldsmith did the music for this. Excellent job.
Yes. Yeah, who did the first film, and he's back for the third film.
Right, Leonard Rosenman did the second film.
That's right.
Oh, so they're winching it in. Okay.
And during the filming of this scene, it broke free from its cable at some point and smashed into the rocks, the mock-up of the ship, and they damaged it.
They're really winching it. That is awesome. They're really winching that in. That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing what it is, which
is
great.
Yeah, it's
authentic, got the crane.
I wish I had that mock-up. I wish I had that spaceship mock-up. Wouldn't that be cool to have in your backyard?
Yeah. It would be, especially if you had kids and they could like.
And then you have to build it out on the inside. And then, of course, you have to have Stewart in her compartment dead.
Of course. That goes without saying.
What do you mean you don't
especially
you don't
for your kids.
Yes. And here's your mummified corpse.
And I like that they didn't shoot this at noon. The sun is down a bit and it's a little more gold, not so harsh.
I think you're looking at some HMIs being blasted in there. What the sun's behind where the sun is.
The angle of the sun's a little more down.
And so we got HMIs coming in on him. I love it.
Oh, it's so exciting.
I know.
They pop it up.
I just remember, you know, I still remember the feeling of seeing this. That's the interesting thing.
It's a really thrilling beginning.
And then you see the astronaut, and of course, back early 70s astronauts. I think we're still going to the moon. Yes. We still were, Apollo's program was still going on. So astronauts definitely. Au courant at the time.
And look at the reflection of those lights.
And those are some great space suits with those helmets, because I don't think the helmets are usually like that. I love this.
I love the space design.
He comes up.
Movies.
Good. Welcome, gentlemen, to the United States. And then, boom.
Jerry Goldsmith, kick it, baby.
That's M. Emmett Walsh in the middle.
This is an awesome main title.
Yeah.
And you see, this is interesting. All they're doing is standing around, but somehow they make the sequence work. Right on the right, that's M. Emmett Walsh.
Welcome back, Roddy.
Roddy McDowell is back. And he looks over. That's a great title sequence. And I can see it. Okay, now we're going to pan over to you, and we're going to have the titles.
She makes a great face.
Branford Dillman. Now, they didn't pan over to Sal Mineo, which is interesting.
Natalie Trundy is back.
Natalie Trundy is back in a different role because she played the mutant lady. William Wyndham plays the president of the United States, and Sal Mineo is in it for some reason. I mean, he is.
We have Eric Braeden as Dr. Haslein.
Dr. Haslein, famous for the Haslein curve.
And did you know that the production designer, or no, the production
Howard
manager,
Lowry. Yes,
production manager suggested Gene Kelly as a director for this movie?
Oh, that would have been so wrong. Jerry Goldsmith. That's a groovy 70s music.
It's also a wonderful
by Jerry Goldsmith.
It's a wonderful Jerry Goldsmith meter. The beat of this music is so cool.
And also there's that atonality to it, which is cool. Now, the interesting thing is now we're going into this and we know who they are. So we already know more than the people
who are meeting them for the first time.
Who are meeting them.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the antagonists, the humans. And Roddy McDowell's back. And the thing is that Roddy McDowell had a chance to play Cornelius before, but this is where he really started to be able to shine. And I mean, this became their franchise. Him and Kim Hunters
became their story.
They're definitely their story.
It dwelled all on them. This is a nice shot to show off that mock-up.
No. Yes.
I just like this. It's a sleek design.
It's excellent. I like that it's all burnt up.
Yeah, very 70s as we hear that orchestration.
That's
I love when they get out of the space shuttle, though, that they're not walking in there like monkey walk. You know what I mean?
Because he can't give it away.
They're trying not
to give it away yet.
Yeah. Right. They're
Paul Dean.
Yeah. But though you can see a little bit of that monkey walk there.
It's great.
I love how Kim Hunter's just, she's holding her shoulders. Just everything's just very all together there.
Great layering in that arrangement on that main title from Jerry Goldsmith.
I like they call the zoo for, well, because I guess they think they're just big monkeys in space.
Monkeys in space. That should have been the name of this.
I think it was. It was a working title.
Uh-huh. That's probably
it just freaks
20th
me
Century Fox, isn't it?
I'd seen the reason why I mentioned that it was M. Emmett Walsh is I'd seen this film so many times and never realized until the last time I saw it. I'm like, wait a minute. And then I realized who it was because I kind of missed the whole middle part of, you know, a chunk of his career.
Oh.
He's like, staring at them.
I can't believe there's apes in there.
Well, yeah.
Because they're changing. That's right.
Oh, modesty. Look at their pretty carpet bag.
Look, he's saying, what the hell am I saying? He's like, I'm apologizing to them. Yeah, it is a nice carpet bag.
Mm-hmm. And their beautiful little carpet bag.
I like that, as you mentioned before, it's being played for its comedy, for its light comedic tones, which is appropriate.
They did take it into comedic territory from the first two incredibly serious dark films.
This is all being, I mean, it's not being complete for fun, but definitely look at this.
It's a new flavor to the franchise, which is what it needed, in my opinion. Yeah.
I mean, there was some comedy, and then here you just play the gag right away. Oh, look at that. That's good.
I love the way he's just looking at
him. He's just like, give me another one.
There's three of us, dude. Thanks. Yeah. Fool.
And I like how she pulls out the plates. And forks and knives, which it's interesting that they would have forks and knives, but I guess that the apes would have evolved with that, as we see in Battle for the Planet of the Apes. Okay.
Interesting enough, they don't have oranges in the future? Because they look to not be very familiar with these oranges.
Where did she get her cutlery?
Actually,
they were inside the cell.
She brought it with her.
Because, oh, she did, yeah.
Yes, because when you're leaving, when your planet's blowing up, it's very important to bring the cutlery.
Because I'm thinking this military outfit wouldn't have knives and forks in this cell.
Right. Yeah, she brought them with her.
She brought in that carpet bag is like Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
She was going to pull out a lamp and a furniture set next?
Yes. This actor, I don't know his name, but he appeared in a bunch of 70s stuff. But he's got that droopy hangdog face look. At least I remember he did.
And a horrible haircut.
Well, it's the 70s. Trust me.
You know,
all haircuts were horrible in the 70s, Heidi.
This really reflects the cage that they put Charlton Heston in the first movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's very similar, like the setup and the room around it and everything.
We've entered the flip side. Everything's the flip side of the first two films we saw.
And there's the very bad gorilla suit. After all the work they'd done in the first two films.
I think that's the same gorilla suit from Conga. Remember that movie?
No.
They should have just put a real stupid gorilla in there. Not like a stupid gorilla. Gorillas aren't stupid.
Have you ever worked with gorillas before?
I didn't mean that.
Yeah, we look forward to your gorilla letters.
You don't want to work with gorilla. You don't want to work with simians on camera.
Whatever, though. I mean, they could have just had him, like, if he's in the other part of the cage and he's just secluded, I mean, what is it really going to do? They're just trying to get a shot of him sitting there.
Well, I'm thinking they could have just, I'm surprised they didn't use the existing ape, the gorilla makeup or getup that they had from the first two films as opposed to having that kind of bigger, you know, more King Kong-ish look.
Well, I know they couldn't have used a real gorilla in that shot because later that gorilla is used in a fight sequence.
No, what I'm saying is when working in film, simians, you are very, very hard to work with. But
it would have been too jarring to go from a real gorilla to their costumed gorilla for the upcoming sequences, I think. So they had to stick with the same gorilla.
Well, that too. But what I'm saying is they could have used the, you know, the gorilla. Oh, here's where we get the explanation from Sal Mineo, who I thought was an interesting choice.
I think this is his last film.
I'm actually really shocked because I guess I didn't realize he was even in this movie we were just watching it.
He was killed shortly after this. Yeah.
I thought he died before this.
But it's like, I don't think Sal Mineo had done anything for a while, and then his name pops up. It's like, whoa, okay, because he was a big star back in the late 50s, early 60s.
When was Exodus? Exodus was
early 60s.
And Rebel Without a Cause was when he first got on the scene.
Yeah.
So, of course, he gets to explain to us everything about how they got to see the Earth destroyed. But I'm just saying, even at the time, it seemed odd. Sal Mineo, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they turn around and have Sal Mineo, and then they off him. I don't know. I guess they had him here so he could explain everything, or he could explain it to us. And I don't know. I'd say that's a weakness in it.
Just have another character?
The way that it was handled, it just never seemed like it didn't sit right with me, you know, to have him. And here we go. We have Bradford Dillman and we have Natalie Trundy.
Natalie Trundy was a trained medic in her real life. So she said she loved this role because she got to...
She did some fine acting in the four films she was in, yeah. Which is good. And Bradford Dillman was a veteran. I mean, he'd been in, I guess, films in the 50s and 60s, but definitely was a TV veteran of the 60s. He was all over the place. A very good actor. Mm-hmm. And so it was good to see him in this.
A good film he's in is called Compulsion. Mm-hmm. Richard Fleischer directed that. Okay. And Bradford Dillman's in that.
Yeah.
Also, I just saw Frank Sansis. St. Francis of Assisi. That's what I saw. And he was the lead role in that. Yeah, he was awesome.
She was a trained medic? Yeah. Honey, you want to be in a film? I know you're a trained medic, but I need an actress.
So she knew just what to do with all the animals.
Okay. Can I play a mutant? All right. Now I want to play a Dr. Arthur. I could see the conversation tonight. Arthur, I want to roll in the next film. Okay. I'm not. Why knock her? She did a great job.
I have to check in. Literally, the check in.
Dig that red turtleneck, man. Not the Wisconsin multiphasic. Well, of course, the whole turnaround is just so incredibly ironic because this is a mild version of what they used to do to humans.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's just playing all very lightly. And that's the thing. I think it really helps that the tone is actually light during this first part because it definitely makes it more effective later when things get really serious, when they find out what they did and, you know, that they actually experimented on humans and killed humans. Like, and they know what the consequence is going to be.
I
that's
love
what
her.
Really
She's
serious.
Like, I'm not stupid.
Yeah. She's like, you're showing me blocks? Yes. Okay, the next one that he does, nice wink.
Yeah, with all that prosthetic makeup on, look at they're all just laughing like these humans are idiots.
now. I remember watching, I've watched some, like, this is not easy for anyone to do. She picks them all out. That was before. I'm like, I can't remember what I ate for breakfast, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's easy.
She's a scientist.
That's right.
And you're giving her blocks.
This is great. She must have had a blast with this.
Yeah. Yeah.
This finally let her character fly in this film.
Yeah.
And by now...
that almost got a laugh in the theater. That definitely got a laugh. Brody McDowell's like, yeah.
And by now, she is such a veteran with that makeup, she knows exactly how to act.
Manipulate it, yeah.
Right, exactly. Oh, you're going to do the banana. Oh, here it comes. I said, we'll offer the banana. Like, this is the big test. Let's see if they can get to the banana. Now, once again, I'm a human. I'm watching this. I'm 10 years old. Like, I don't even know how to get up there.
I love it. She's just looking around.
And she's like, really? You want me to do this?
Yeah, he's like, yeah, really. That's she's really, like, I mean, that's all right, fine. I don't even like bananas. You're being stupid.
It's great. with the facial gestures. I mean, that's what's really great. Just with the facial gestures, they're getting everything. It. Nice.
I love how she sees just two right away, how they all click into each other and make stares.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying. Okay, and here comes the big line, and we're 16 minutes in. And that's not easy to play what they just played.
Yeah.
And I think they played it
really
it's
well.
Like, it's like right on the line. Oh, Milo, you see this? Now you see, Dr. Milo, this is what happens when you complain. Gorillas kill you.
When she's too smart, that's what the best part about it. Yeah. She can't even sit there and play stupid.
Right.
And now, finally, they get to understand what Taylor had to deal with in right. the first movie when they're telling him to play stupid.
Well, experientially now.
Which she understood, but still, he had to do it to survive. Yeah.
Right.
Part of Zira's makeup, she had an incredible will and stubbornness about her. If you watch the first movie, her interactions with Roddy McDowell, and so it makes perfect sense that her character would do that in this one.
Oh, and it's great continuity for characters. I mean, to have her character, of course, there we go.
Yeah, this is a bit convenient just to get rid of him.
Yeah.
I don't know if I liked all the cats. I was waiting for Tarzan to start yelling because that's what they did in the Tarzan movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't well, Sal.
Sal, you had a short part.
It's actually pretty sad for, like, the prosperity of their species. You know what I mean? Like, it would... If they're thinking about, you know, procreating and continuing their species in this new time period, it really does kind of narrow their chances of doing that because there's a whole other gene pool that's just been eliminated.
Well, I think Zira was just going to stick with Cornelius, if you know what I mean.
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I think, yes, intentionally, that's what they want to do. But I'm just saying, I'm just thinking of this from like a logical scientific standpoint.
Yeah, for gene pool, yes. Yeah. Yes, yeah. He has no idea how to talk to them. Okay, you know I'm going to bring up the obvious complaint. You know what I'm going to say. Well, but this is the complaint we had in about the first films. It's like, okay, and they're all speaking English? Okay, all right. I'm done. I'm not going to go any further.
Right.
It's for convenience sake.
Again, suspension of disbelief because of the entertainment factor. I'll give it that.
Yeah, and we kind of went through with Planet of the Apes anyway.
Right.
Yeah, so that problem was asked and answered, and so it's done. But now we get it presented again, but still, okay. Actually, in science fiction, I think the only place I've ever... I mean, you can't deal with it in film because film is the way it is. You know, it's very concrete. But I think there's one book I read that actually dealt with it pretty well, and it's called Pebble in the Sky. And it's Asimov, and a guy gets, you know, projected thousands of years into the future. And basically, you go through the whole thing where he's learning the language. And then eventually he knows that language so he can communicate. But you can do that with a book. You can't do that with a movie.
Right, yeah. Right.
It's great how they like just dive right into the politics of it right away.
Right.
I think one of the reasons why I always react well to this film when I think about it or entertain the notion of watching it is for Roddy McDowall and Kim Hunter's performances.
Absolutely.
I think that's really, for me, what I like to connect to in this movie.
But I even like the Bradford Dillman and Natalie Trondy performances because they essentially become their, I mean,
their counterparts
and their friends.
Yeah.
And their allies. Mm-hmm. And very warm and comfortable allies.
Which we need by this time in this series. We need some allies.
Yeah,
and some people coming together for good.
Coming together for the good, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, exactly. Please have some representation of that, you know? And,
William Wyndham, yes.
Yeah, I think he's reading a cue card.
Great. Well, but he's reading a cue card very well. I don't mind. I guess he was on TV. He was on Twilight Zones and everything. He had he had a TV show in the early 70s called My World and Welcome to It, and there's Eric Braeden.
Yeah, there's Eric Braeden.
Who is this?
Murmuring.
This is post-Corbin, Forbin Project.
This is post-Colossus and a film that Eric Braeden is very well known for. Mm-hmm. And that's just James Bacon, isn't it? James Ooh. Bacon, the Hollywood columnist, who is playing one of the
really?
Guys that just asked a question. That guy in the center blue outfit.
Wow.
Let's look at the credits, and if we see James Bacon, let's remember that. Anyway, Eric Braeden had done Colossus by this point, and Don Taylor, the director, Arthur P. Jacobs had seen Colossus, liked Eric Braeden, thought he'd be perfect for this role in this movie, and Arthur P. Jacobs ran Colossus for Don Taylor. And Don Taylor, after seeing Colossus, said, that's our guy. Hire him.
Oh, absolutely.
So he was hired by doing Colossus.
And, of course, he plays the famous Dr. Hasline, who was mentioned in the first two films, mm-hmm. most prominently by Taylor, who mentioned they think they've passed through a Hasline curve.
Wonderful.
And I guess...
point to pick up on and flesh out for your sequels.
I mean, I guess he was supposed to be like a character. I think it was supposed to be like an Einstein substitute, you know, a great brain of science who... his theories about space when, I don't know, I mean, it's just like, okay, let's make up the science and then we go with it. And so now to have him here, absolutely, in the film is pretty, it's like awesome. It's great. What do I like to call? Continuity porn.
Paul Dean.
But it's really good.
Picked up on that and ran.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
So, and then, of course, he turns out to be a bad... You want a villain, Heidi?
Yeah. Eric Braeden.
Dr. Hasline is a villain.
Eric Braeden played a lot of villains on TV like Rat Patrol and other things. And so he was getting sort of tired of playing villains.
Oh,
so he wasn't looking forward to this role because it was another villain. But he did have a great time on the film, he said. And he enjoyed making it. And he enjoyed that he never had to put on an ape mask.
Right. And but also he doesn't play it as a...
Whoa.
Yeah. As a villain. He just plays it as a man of science and I'm serious about what I'm doing. But,
once again...
Well, the ending is brutal.
I think the ending answers the question
but
as to whether he's a villain or not.
He is just like on the planet of the apes, like the apes. He's like Zaius. I mean, in a way, he is our Zaius.
Yeah.
He really is our Zaius because Zaius would turn around and might not shoot Nova in the back, but he could possibly do it if he wanted to turn it around that way.
Class system.
Yeah, that's right.
Everyone, you got to have a class system no matter what.
Because she just said, you know, she was handcuffed. She said... about the gorillas thing, and it's like...
What do you think we are, gorillas?
And she makes a lot of those comments. She makes a lot of those class...
Yeah, she does that a lot, actually, gorillas.
She got it out for...
I think something happened to her in her childhood about gorillas, because even in the last film, she was talking about how stupid they are.
Yeah.
I just think...
Well, because they're...
Zira had a bad experience growing up with gorillas.
They're hyper-aggressive, and they basically didn't listen to anything anyone else said. This I felt the film went a little quick. In other words, it leaped a little too fast. Maybe for the time it was okay, but now I would imagine if they redid this film, they'd be kept under wraps and no one would they wouldn't let the world know that there were any apes or any aliens or anything that. It would all be a very clandestine type of thing.
Right. Interesting they have a man of the cloth on the board.
Oh, yeah.
To represent that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, she understands and she stands up.
Yep.
Now, that's a great character actor, that guy, second from the right.
Yeah.
He was in tons of stuff.
Oh, that's John Randolph.
I don't know his name.
Oh, yeah. He did lots of films. Actually, he lot character actor in lots of things. He was in Seconds, oh. Frankenheimer's Seconds. He played the character that John Rock Hudson was before he changed.
I see.
I think that was probably the biggest one, but lots of character actor stuff,
yeah,
lots of TV.
Saw him on all the stuff, everything.
Oh, yes. Like, she's just like, you're an idiot.
Yep. I love her spark. It's fantastic. Wait, who is this guy?
This is John Randolph. So of course it's played for laughs, and of course, but then of course we have Eric Braden, who's like, okay, now this is
huge.
Not good.
He realizes. What I love is how,
look at that,
this goes actually in reality television celebrity territory, because
yeah.
Cornelius and Zira become celebrities.
Yeah.
Oh, and you can see it happening in real life, that that's something that could definitely take place.
Like, wedded.
How could they be married? They're animals. Now, this is interesting.
Sort of answering what you were talking about.
Friendly 2,000
yeah.
years. Okay, so they're all right. So I guess this justifies it. And this is great, so now they're bringing the ape thinking in. And she's... And that's so now Zira's basically saying...
Here she is, dissing the gorillas again,
yeah.
Heidi.
And the orangutans also.
Pseudoscientific geese. Pseudoscientific geese.
Ooh.
No.
Eric Braden has such a wonderful presence.
Yeah.
That guy, he occupies his space really well.
See, I'm watching this now and they're saying this and I'm like...
And the people are just like, no way.
I said it before. I just think now, the whole thing of having it in front of people, but I guess maybe the past 30, 40 years have changed things for me. I don't know. And so now they get the explanation of how they basically got away. Oh, that's right. So he explains.
What I want to know is how they got that ship up out of the water.
Well, they got it out of the water, and he cleaned it up, and then they managed to take off. Now, here's my point about Lucius. They left Lucius behind.
Yeah.
That really upsets me.
There's only so much room in that little ship.
Uh-oh.
Of course the female knows.
How does she know?
They're just digging their own grave.
Oh, because she saw the dial on the spacecraft thing.
She's smart.
She is smart. Actually, she is.
When she talks about Dr. Milo being a genius beyond his time, like, she really is, because she also, I mean, she's a psychiatrist, so she dissects the thinking of people, and she spent a lot of time with Taylor, you know? I mean, I think that she learned a lot from that interaction. She picks up on social cues. She picks up on small evidence.
Oh, and this is where
they've
decided that they don't know. He looked at her, and she just basically said,
no.
She shook her head.
Yeah.
And then she looked down.
And she's saying, they're emphasizing the whole thing, that they're peaceful creatures, that they're pacifists.
Right.
That it's the gorillas and the orangutans who are doing war. So it's interesting. So they kind of scoped it out within this context about being not letting in, trying to not be dangerous, even though they know that they could be perceived as a danger.
Right. I wonder why they did choose to not tell him about Taylor.
I think they explain later.
They do that? Okay.
Yeah, they do.
Because I don't remember. I guess I just didn't remember that coming up.
Yeah, I'd forgotten
in the conversation.
I'd forgotten about that, but it is a subtlety, but it does come up later because I think it has to do with them not wanting to give away too much about like what really is happening. You
the
know.
Persecution of Taylor and how Taylor was handled and treated
humans
would not go well with his people.
Right.
When you go back and tell them what happened to Taylor.
Yeah.
So it puts them in a bad light if they were to do that.
No comment yet.
But she just straight up said she's only known two humans that have ever spoken.
Right. But they didn't ask who they were. That's the thing. And then, of course, they ask, but maybe they're assuming, of course, they can't possibly know them.
They're your friends.
And now here, writing-wise, this is interesting. They withheld the information, and now this way they can actually introduce the information, at least within this context.
So if you realize that you have less money for every subsequent film, and how do you save money? You go from Beneath the Planet of the Apes, where you had all your mutant makeup, all your apes makeup,
to having just people.
And you have the next one where only two are required. Well, actually, Sal Mineo.
Three, you're right.
But only three.
Well, three and a half in the gorilla suit, which clearly they didn't spend much on.
They rented that from Sid Caesar's collection from old comedy shows or something.
They rented it from the prop shop down the street. Well, here you go. Now they're explaining exactly how humans were, they used their bodies alive and dead, what they did with humans. And basically
what you do to us.
Yeah.
We did it to you.
Mm-hmm. Shoe, other foot. How do you like it?
See?
Yeah.
You just can't say
it is
much.
True. Yeah, people wouldn't want to know about it.
What? What's the other reason? Okay. Oh, because that's why they didn't tell them that they saw the Earth destroyed.
Yeah.
And then see where she drops the bomb. See, actually, this is a great way for essentially teasing out all the information, the info dump. We're teasing out the info dump right now.
So you were saying if you hadn't seen the first two...
Right, then you can still get a little. Right now.
But also, to bring up the characters here up to date, which we have, you know, there has to be some kind of recapping of some sort for adults and for children.
Well, yeah,
children
and the kids, the kids, the gorillas, the chimpanzees, the apes, Zira and Cornelius.
Wow, keep going.
my mind,
whittling it down.
It's jumping. It's good to hear them recall what they saw again and explain it because we didn't see them towards the end of the last movie at all.
Right. They were gone.
They were gone.
Absolutely.
So it's nice to know what they were doing, what they were experiencing.
And then we get to see, exactly, we see their experience. And also, it allows us to be invested in the stakes that are here because by telling the two doctors, Stevie and the other guy whose name I've
they know what their future is.
They exactly. And then you have other people sharing their stakes. That can, you know, their allies essentially can't that can't share their stakes.
Stake.
Okay, now we're getting the time travel explanation, which honestly makes no fracking sense. where Dr. Otto Haslein explains infinite regression, what does that have to do with time
can
travel?
You,
Tim, I'm looking at you. What does that have to do with time travel?
Infinite regression?
Yes. Because he does a whole painting thing where I'll look at Heidi. Heidi, what does that have to do with time travel?
I love it. Can you please explain infinite regression to us? The TV anchor asks.
But my point is, what does infinite regression have to do with them traveling backwards through time? Okay. The dude on the right is completely lost. That's a nice anamorphic picture. They got the nice detail in the background there. Okay, Dr. Haslein, how did they travel back in time? I want an explanation.
This guy has no idea. The news anchor has no idea what this guy's
doing. Dude, you are flipping out. Okay. Okay, so we... Right, observer and observed. Oh, it's like a... Time's like a freeway. I
with
get
an
it.
Infinite number of lanes.
And you can just go on to... Oh, here... Okay.
You can go forward and backward.
He's explaining... I don't know... I think it's bullshit that he just explained, but actually what he's setting up now plot-wise is that you can change the future. He's saying that one, you can always have different futures, which is key to what,
to the point of even having this movie.
Right, because he's convinced that basically he can change the future because he already sees, he's already put together that they will mate and that they will then create the Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
So he thinks he will stop it, and that's why that's part of his belief that he can, there are other realities as opposed to one timeline. But that's what this film disproves. There is only one time. In other words, you can try and mess with the timeline, but it ain't going to happen.
Huh.
It's like what some TV show recently was just trying to make the point, is that you can keep on trying. I mean, I guess Lost was making the point about... was it Lost? I don't even remember. You can try and change things, but you really can't. The universe will self-correct itself. I don't know, mm-hmm. It was something.
But you can still change minor things.
You can change minor things, but the big things that you're trying, you know, like...
Brown Derby. I'm sorry.
Brown Derby's gone.
Yeah, exactly. That completely dates this as one of those kind of movies. Oh. It's like, oh, we're in Hollywood. You know what I mean?
That's Wilshire right there.
Yep.
Oh, I know exactly where that is.
Beverly Wilshire.
Beverly Wilshire.
Where's Pretty Woman?
We just had the film camera and the reflection of that car. Oh. Also, I like the fact that in their cell, they decorated it and had furniture.
Yeah.
And
right.
Just to go through the legalities, you have to be in the cell, but that doesn't mean you can't be civilized.
Which is right. Really cool. And it's now, of course, they're playing. Now here's the satires.
And now here's our celebrities.
Exactly. Now there's a very modern take. It is a rather modern take.
No. But see, this is also what's interesting. Like, coming from the perspective of the apes in this, it's like not only they're in the past, but they're also in
a future.
Yeah.
In a way, you know? It's what an interesting journey for them to be on.
Mm-hmm.
They're in civilization. I mean, they have electricity, because I think we talked about this in Beneath, because they didn't have electricity. They didn't, well, they maybe they had running water of some sort. But here, this is the electric world.
Yeah.
And it's modern, and it's also very square. I mean, if you really want to go there, I don't think they really thought it through that much. But it's modern.
I hear some Jerry Goldsmith.
I hear music.
He has
that. Oh, that's some really cheesy 70s, early 70s piano.
70s acoustic sound.
Okay, where's that? We've got to identify the streets.
It looks like it's in the valley. Wasn't it a little bit?
No.
That cafe thing? No.
Looking for landmarks. Oh, look, there's the apes. Hey, have you heard about the apes?
It would totally be like that, though. I mean, if the world knew about them, they would be huge celebrities. Talking apes from the future.
Like I said, their reality show TMZ, would be number one.
TMZ would be all over it.
So
it's not a big suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
You know?
No. Though it's the old style limousine. Oh, my God. Look at him
giggle.
In his suit.
Oh, he looks so handsome. Look at her.
This is probably one of the two greatest roles Ronnie McDowell's ever had. This and Caesar. Though now I'm going to post my...
Caesar?
State my thesis. For Conquest.
Yes.
But more importantly for Battle. Because if you watch Conquest, he does his gig and he doesn't play Cornelius. He does find another way to play Caesar.
Look at that mullet. Yeah, rock that.
Look at that
model.
Hair. Oh, I remember that hair. That hairstyle is definitely 70s. But basically, by the time Battle comes around, that's when you really get to see Caesar's personality as opposed to what he did with Cornelius. And he did make changes, which is pretty amazing. And my contention is that Battle actually is a great character film for Caesar, for Roddy McDowell. It's probably...
I think that these two characters are just...
Oh, they're adorable.
Absolutely wonderful, adorable, lovable... they're like there's the cat's meow.
Our sympathies are completely with them.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So the ending is pretty hard.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but that's the whole point here.
Whole point.
And I think that's
no one saw that coming.
Actually,
that ending.
That's probably the brilliance of actually what Dean did here is that he did set it up that they were so likable, and you never got a chance to see. I mean, you got to see their humanity, so to speak, in the films because they cared for Taylor and tried to help, but they were in such an oppressive environment when you think about it.
But I love, yeah, because now they get to really look at their, they're actually blossoming. Yeah, because they were the forward thinkers. They were, you know, they were the minority in their time. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, they get to experience life a little bit more. They just get to be themselves.
Well, they get to experience civilization.
Right.
Well, more modern civilization than the more primitive civilization they actually
right, that had. Warring civilization.
What is that seesaw toy?
I know. I saw that when they first come into the thing, and I'm like, why did they have a seesaw? That's like the weirdest thing I could ever imagine.
Yeah.
He got up, and she fell backwards.
Like
that's
that.
A
he's in
70s
his,
robe.
He's in his robe with his... Wow. Look at the socks on his feet.
And we get to see his...
Because look, he's got the opposable toe.
Yeah. I think he's wearing the gay flag for his robe.
he's not taking this well. He's just like, oh, this is tough. Wow. He's thinking, what kind of world have we landed in?
I think this exact outfit my grandpa had, like the same robe and the same pajamas. I think that's the exact outfit.
That is the most color this film will ever see.
Yeah.
Well, it's an interesting choice that they did right there, why they gave him that much. They could have given him any kind of robe. That is definitely distinctly a choice.
Aww.
You're right. It is a happy time.
Mm-hmm.
This is their, I mean, it's like a rainbow. The Bay Area women, what is it, Long Beach? Oh, no. This is so satirical. It's incredible. See? Apes are like humans.
But see, I like that this, because this is really relevant. Remember how I was talking about in Beneath how, you know, even though these apes have risen to this sort of, this like kind of like, you know, sentient kind of society, but how like the women still didn't have any rights and how they were still like second class citizens. And it, you know, still made me think of like the Roman Empire and all that. And then here you see Zira finally getting, you know, cause this is what's relevantly going on in, you know, American, political society and whatnot at the time that they're supposed to be there is this women's rights movement.
Right.
So you get to see Zira finally here with these other women, like pushing for something she would have pushed in her own time.
If she'd been able to, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I think she wanted to. You know, I think if they would have continued on in the, you know, Taylor hadn't blown up the world, Zira and Cornelius would have actually forged a really great society or begun one.
Well, but in the primitive sense, exactly, with what they had and with, you know,
right,
essentially where they were without electricity and very big populations. Because, I mean, really what they've encountered is a high degree of civilization. That's a really bad...
It's horrible.
What do I want to call it? I don't want to call it a stuffed animal, but it's... what's it called when you...
taxidermy?
Yeah. I guess if it's a real...
But I don't think
that didn't look real. It was just awful. I just always thought, it was like, oh. And she's pregnant. Then, of course, she tells Dr. Hasline. Wonderful.
The plot thickens.
Plot thickens, and we're only 42 minutes in.
And look at how much color she has in her outfit at this point.
She's got the pink, and she has the red cape.
No.
Oh, no. The grape juice plus. Oh, my God. Now, that's interesting. They don't... Ape culture doesn't have alcohol.
Hmm.
Oh, they never discovered alcohol, or they never developed it in a way. That's what they're saying.
You can definitely see the budgets being cut with each new movie. The fast lighting setups.
Who told her that was grape juice plus? And why is he letting her drink that when she's pregnant?
Because he's...
he's evil.
He's Dr. Otto Hasline, and he knows that she's
pregnant.
I mean,
she'll be fine. Like,
it's the downfall of humanity.
You can have, like, a drink here or there and, like, not ruin your child.
He's not worried about that. He's worried about basically getting her aborted or killed. He knows what's going... He already knows everything that's going on. And he's just got to tease it all out. He wants to get information.
Wow. Kim Hunter sitting in the chair again under all those makeup appliances.
Okay, now that's evil. He's got a cigarette case with a tape recorder. Okay.
That is definitely evil. People always have those.
You know, in the villain handbook, that's what you have. That's like on page 54. Make sure you have your cigarette case with the tape recorder in it. And now structure wise, she gets to explain to essentially the antagonist the status of her world.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't know he's the antagonist. That's the brilliance of it.
She's digging in her grave.
But now we get to find out about it. Yeah, this is how we come find out about how the world ended.
She's had one glass and she's drunk. This makes no sense.
She's not used to it.
She's
tolerant.
She's a cheap date.
I still don't buy it.
Okay, here we go. Here's the time thing. Oh, she said, okay, she's the one who says 3950 something. Yeah, the 3950 something comes up. That's what comes up in battle. I love what the president says. Mr. Snark. That's. Okay, so here's the president. He's got the actual year. 3955. So it's 3975 when Taylor landed. They changed it to 3955. In battle, they say 3950 or 3950 something, and they just cut it off at 3950. Big deal, I know. Now we get the nice little religious allusion there to Herod and Jesus.
Well, because it makes sense that in these films, every time there's like some sort of political decision being made, it references someone's, you know, personal beliefs.
Yeah. Kind of like, but that's also like in, it's interesting, almost like in Beneath.
Yeah.
It was always like about that. It was about challenging the firmly held beliefs and then being challenged.
Right. Because in Beneath, it's like not only the apes' belief, but also the mutants.
Mutants, yeah.
So.
These films do have a common thread of that, challenging
I think
common
really,
beliefs.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that, you know, you have Dr. Haslein who's just like, you know, they're going to destroy it. And the president's just like, you know what? I can hear what you're saying. I can kind of believe it. You may be right. You may be wrong. But, you know, I'm not going to fly off the handle in a big, huge panic. And that's a white chair that he's sitting in. Oh, my God, because it's whatever, 1973, supposedly. But he's like really level-headed about it, which I like. It's a nice track in behind him.
Mm-hmm.
To make the emphasis.
Talking with the president. Yet again, if you watch Colossus, he talks to the president a lot in that movie too.
Oh, really? Oh, I've forgotten about that.
Yeah. He talks to the news reporters just like he talked to the news reporters in this movie. It's actually a lot of similarities.
Only in Colossus, he's the good guy.
Right, yes.
But in Colossus, he talks to the president on a little screen.
You know what
and
I love about this?
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm just interjecting. But
what
I love about this film and this conversation right now that the doctor and the president are having is that they're so concerned with preventing this future where there's apes that they're not even actually like thinking about the fact that why were there only apes? Why were the humans dumb? Why was the world less civilized? You know, I mean, not less civilized, but technologically advanced where they hadn't gone into space they're not even remotely considering the possibility that because the humans have some sort of nuclear war, which is what we know to be the truth from the first two films, they're not even considering that that's the possibility of why this future occurs. You know, automatically, they're just assuming that this future only occurs because these apes went back in time.
Right.
Which, again, they never would have had an opportunity to do if the humans hadn't gone forward in time.
Right, exactly. Anyway. In a way, it's setting itself up. It's nice. Well, that was the brilliant thing. They set up their own time loop. which was a cool idea to do. I mean, you could say, well, it's a little bit cheap, but they still work through the ideas. And even then, their conversation there, they were still kind of not getting the fact. They were saying, well, we can try and change the future. And that gets back to the whole thing about Hasline, plot-wise, insisting that he can change the future, even though they say they come from that future and he believes that future exists and that he can stop it, whereas the president's sort of like, well, I don't know. You know, it may just be going to happen. But let's go ahead and go through, you know, the different
steps. But you couldn't stop. But if you think about any sort of, like, if you really think about time travel and you think about any theories of time travel, if killing them prevents the future from happening where they would be in the future, then they wouldn't have been able to come back to the past.
Well, yeah. Well, but that's Hasline's theory is that basically there are different futures. So in other words, they can all branch off, which is why he insists that he can possibly do that.
Change their future. Yeah, which, I mean, I guess that does make sense.
As opposed to, I know this is the future, I can't do anything about it, so...
My brain hurts.
But, well, you're welcome to the time zone on this one.
But again, what I think is the real problem here is that they're trying to prevent apes from taking over the planet rather than thinking why were the humans in a position in the future to have
the bigger picture?
The why this happened, instead of thinking maybe we could change the future by not having atomic bombs.
It's narrow-minded.
And that, that's exactly what I was going to say. It's very short-sighted, and they're thinking that that guy on the left, he's a character actor. I don't remember his name, but he did a lot of stuff. He's really good. One of the interrogators. But yeah, but that's exactly, they're being myopic. They're not seeing outside of that. They don't realize that what they're doing now is actually causing the future, because if they didn't do this, then it's likely that none of the other stuff would happen, and that they are actually, by trying to change things or you know, determine, say, well, we can make this happen, they are actually causing it to happen, and they are part of the problem.
Right.
Which gives it great irony, because we know, watching it the whole time, this is all ironic. They're not going to succeed.
Again, it drives home what every other film has said, is that man, no matter how you go man is going to destroy himself.
Get it, Cornelius.
Murdering one another.
Again, man destroys man. Ape, that's right. Ape shall not kill ape. Man, that's what Ursus said. Ape does not kill ape.
Yeah.
Back in Beneath. He wouldn't even shoot the apes that were supposedly dying.
Right.
And when he thought it was an illusion.
But what I'm seeing in the first one to the second one to this one is it's man's destiny is self-destruction.
And then, even when he's just revealed to them that you led to the destruction of your own kind. He still says, that's not what, the doctor's like, that's not what I want to talk about. I want to know how you guys rose to the top. It's just silly.
Because he can't conceive of how it could have possibly happened. But now he's explaining what happened, the origin, the whole thing with the story of the pets and everything. I'm like, that's great.
Mm-hmm. Can't you just imagine they're, you know, sitting around kicking around ideas, the writers, of how to
Paul, really?
Explain and the chronology of this whole thing?
And what's amazing is afterwards they take this kernel of the story and then they run with it in the next film. That's great.
Yeah.
Apes is beyond the pets. They already skip. Well, here he says, in the course of less than two centuries. Whereas all they did in the film was made it 20 years, if that. Because I think in the, I think they say it's like in 1983 came the dog and cat plague. Albert Salmi is his name, that character actor. The guy on the right.
I recognize the name.
And I hear they're talking about three more centuries. So here the chronology is even more messed up about how it is. And of course, maybe the, you know, the whole time thing got changed. So we're talking about 500 years. But corporate and militant action? Wow. And this is a great speech that he gives. All right, listen, let's talk Aldo really quickly. Aldo. Now, here they say that Aldo's the one who said no. But then they didn't pursue it in the movies. Now, I think I think Aldo says no in Conquest? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But then Aldo shows up in Battle for the Planet of the Apes. And Aldo is bad. I had a problem with that. I know. I'm getting picky about the continuity. I think it's a great story that they explain there, you know, about this whole thing. I think it's great. But
this is a really good scene.
It is. No, it is.
We start to get dark from here.
Well, because
on out.
Now it all gets dark because now they're confronted with what their previous life was and they can't get away from it. And having to tell the truth and just realizing that they are now the, I mean, we, you know, obviously it's Taylor.
Oh.
Can't laugh your way out of this one.
Yeah. Yep.
I like Dixon.
Yep.
Not too many tracking shots in this movie. It's a lot of sticks.
Well, not a lot of time to set shots up. It's like, you know,
it's plant TV production.
Plant that camera.
Well, here we go.
There's a move here.
I was hoping for one good. Eric Braeden's been on The Young and the Restless for like, what, 26 or almost 30 years?
Ages, yeah.
And the last feature I saw him in was Titanic, and that was 97.
That's right.
He was, who was the rich guy? The real rich guy that...
Yeah, I forget the name. It's interesting the cultural thing. He's like afraid. He knows that they only use it to kill them, to kill humans.
Right.
They never used needles on themselves
for medicine or anything.
Yeah. Yeah, we're definitely in the dark territory here.
Aww.
And in a way, it's basically, you know, we spent the first half kind of having them discover the new world and everything. And now we're basically spending the rest of the time, or at least this time, unpacking what the truth is of what was that world was like and how, because they come from that world through no fault of theirs, they're responsible for what that world is as compared to... It's like a clash of cultures. And that this culture won't stand for, you know, that culture, so to speak. And really, there is quite an intolerance going on in this film.
This is horrible how they're drugging our Francers.
Yeah.
This is where everything really turns.
Well, interesting, and they're dressed in their original clothes.
Well, because I think
they've been stripped of...
Well, I think maybe they did that. That's the impression I took was that they wanted to dress in their own clothes because they were reclaiming their own identity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm glad he's staying with her.
Good.
Get it, Dixon.
Dixon's staying, and Albert saw me.
I just like seeing, you know, it's really like nice seeing the human doctors be the same way, you know, that Zira and Cornelius were to Taylor. It's just, it's just nice.
Right.
It's comforting because they're the ones that are, I think, are the ones that hopefully you as an audience member, you relate to these people. Because
well, they're
the
hope.
They're the goodness.
They're the hope.
Yeah.
In this whole messed up, crazy caravan of a universe.
See, it's like they're, I mean, the thing is, with all these questions, they're just kind of trying to peg them on having been, you know, creatures who actually experimented on humans, and like that's the worst crime because in that culture that's what it did, and that they're criminals because they came from that culture. That's the I mean, I don't know.
That's a tough angle on Kim Hunter due to the makeup,
mm-hmm.
because of her mouth. I'm wondering if we're going to see a real mouth inside.
And here and now we're getting, now we're unpacking more of the truth. Gorillas onto them for sport. Flashback to Planet of the Apes.
You see, I can see her lips past the ape lips.
Barely, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that wasn't a target practice shot. That was Dodge getting shot. But that's exactly what we do to,
yeah,
to animals. I mean,
yeah,
you know, she's saying she, they did the same thing that mm-hmm. we do to animals right now.
Mm-hmm. That's a test of the makeup, that shot, that direct light on her from the profile side.
Yeah.
That shot right there. You got to have a real good makeup session.
And now they're
talking day shoot.
Yeah, now they're talking about lobotomies. Oh, because that's the whole thing. They were trying to
make them talk.
To trying to figure out how to make humans talk. Oh, and here's Colonel Taylor. There you go.
Now there's a connection.
There you go.
Now she knows what she's done.
Oh, she'll get it. Wow.
A permanent one.
Oh, the poor orderly.
To its quarters.
Yeah, he won't even admit that. Wow.
They should never have lied, though. Honest, I mean.
Well, yeah. They thought they could get out of it.
Woulda, shoulda, coulda.
Yeah.
Hindsight.
But they should have just been honest. I know it was. They seemed like it would have been a lot for everybody to handle, but at least they would have had nothing to hide.
Well, due to that, they appear incredibly suspicious now.
Right, exactly. Which is what always happens when you lie about things.
Right. I guess here, this takes place. The priest is arguing that they're married. But this takes place 2 years in the future from when this came out.
Yeah.
See, here they're pegging the whole thing about actions against the human race.
It's like Judgment at Nuremberg.
But would they call it, let's see, he makes the point, would they call it in 2,000 years? No. It's a very fine parsing of cult, of different culture mores. It's the interesting thing. And it's
true.
Yeah. And then, of course, we get Dr. Hasline's, you know, they could be dangerous, so we must control them now.
Oh, Dixon.
Oh, that's very, very charitable.
They are savages.
Yeah. And see, he's, you know, this whole thing about needles. He's got this whole thing because for him, you never put a needle into an ape. And it really offends him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I told him about Taylor.
Yeah.
You should have just told him, guys. But see, where they come from, keeping secrets actually did behoove them.
Right. They had to keep secrets to basically survive. That's,
right.
That's what I'm saying.
So yeah, they don't know any better.
It was a more oppressive thing. You know, with Zaius, they had to keep secrets as much as possible.
Yeah.
So that was, you know. I'm trying to think. Did Taylor keep secrets from them? Taylor didn't. Taylor was as forthcoming as he could be. They just never believed him.
Right. They never believed him.
They never mm-hmm. believed him. Ugh, poor orderly. dude, don't say the wrong thing. Please, I've watched this movie a million times. Do not say the wrong thing. Oh. Oh, see? You shouldn't have called him a little monkey.
Don't forget your bag.
That has everything in it.
It has everything in it.
Including the forks and knives.
Including the spaceship, I think.
I love this. They see the cool music kicks in.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's the escape music.
Mm-hmm.
With some wah-wah guitar thrown in.
Right. Okay, turn around. Grab the
yep,
bag.
See?
She grabs the bag. She closes the door, but you know what? It ain't good.
Blood.
Man, yeah. I have to say, though, like...
That orderly didn't deserve that.
And I can't believe he died like that. Like, I just don't think Cornelius came with enough force to kill him.
I think, well...
He fell on the glasses, and the glasses shattered and stabbed him.
Simians are really strong, so if when he threw him back, if he fell on the back of his head, he could have just as easily...
Yeah, I guess so.
That's the whole thing. That's why they had that thing on the blood there, so I'm just...
Wow.
You prefer the parents dead, too. Wow. Oh, man, Hasline is cold-blooded.
Yeah, he is. And it's not going to change anything. Like, that's what's so silly.
That's the thing is, we know that. Now, if we saw this movie without knowing the movies before or movies after, would we think that Hasline was right or wrong? And I think that's that's an interesting way to look at it. See, now we're getting back into the comedy somehow. That was funny.
But we would still know a lot of things, even if we only saw this one. Like, we would know Taylor came to the future and that they loved him.
Mm-hmm.
We would know that the gorillas and the apes were oppressive,
yes.
Or the gorillas and the orangutans. We would know that whatever escalated into that future ended it. They wanted to escape. But we would also know what they revealed to us in that meeting in the office about how he knew in the histories that, like, man had, like, defeated themselves, you know? And we would know that us as humans had evolved to a place where we were stupider and slower than we are now.
Right.
I mean, all of that is evidence, okay. You know.
Yeah. I like that gag, by the way, where...
Good night, Charlie.
Yeah, good night, Charlie.
He took a risk.
but it was a bit of levity. This is the thing. Once they put a bit of levity in there,
mm-hmm.
Recalling some of the levity from earlier on, but still this is, you know, it's definitely getting to the dire... Sorry, Eric.
Yeah, it shocked me the way it shifted gears at the dock scene.
Oh, it's already started shifting now. But
no, but I mean the way
end,
it
yeah.
went into high gear at the dock. I was just oh my gosh.
How pregnant is she? How long have they been there?
Mm.
How's
she
been?
She was pregnant before they left.
I know, but how long's the gestation period? I'm sure it's like similar to humans, and she wasn't huge. She wasn't showing. Maybe it's been a few months. I don't know. I'll give the benefit of the doubt.
They've probably been here a few months. And then there was definitely like a few months. I mean, we didn't see her like almost the whole previous movie. And we knew at the very beginning of the movie she was pregnant.
Oh, okay. All right.
So that could have been, you know, several months or more. You know, I mean, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, he did. I like the blood on the cloth. Oh yeah. What?
A stone rolling that'll gather enough poison moss to kill us all.
Okay. All right. Hasline.
He doesn't make any sense. Does anybody else around him realize he makes no sense?
They should have realized once he started talking about infinite regression.
The Emperor's New Clothes with that guy. Exactly.
You see, there's a painter painting a painting of himself, painting a painting.
But then you pull
there's
back.
A rock, and there's mm-hmm. poison moss.
And because of...
And what's missing?
And
another painter.
and because of that, there's a highway with infinite exits that you can take going backward and forward in time. See? Stupid. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, how do we sidestep? The concrete logic in this film.
It's like, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah,
dress it up
sure.
in fancy words and spew it out.
That's right. next time someone challenges me on something, I will say, do you know the concept of infinite regression?
Yeah, that's a great crutch. That's a great crutch to have.
If you don't understand it, come back when you understand it, and then we can talk.
That's right.
Which will be never.
Because I don't understand it.
I mean, I think I kind of know what he's talking about.
No, that's because you want to think you kind of know.
Please explain it to me, because I'm a pretty smart cookie, and I don't get what he's talking about in relation to time travel.
I mean, I don't know what it has to do with time travel.
No, I got
she just sees a lot of paintings, and she likes that.
Oh.
I mean, I think he's always saying that, like, something always happened before the step that's happening.
I got that part.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Now, the president's angry.
The president's
angry. The president's arguing with Hasselein, who's saying that the mass murders of tomorrow. I'd like better emotionally.
I love how the president kind of hates Hasselein.
I don't think he gets along with him or his methods. He knows where Hasselein's coming from. He doesn't like coming from that same place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the president stalked you, Hasselein, alive. And of course he's like, fuck the president, asshole.
And that's why the president hates him, because he already knows.
Yeah.
The president's like, this man never listens to me and I'm on top.
That's right. And even the president doesn't get the concept of infinite regression.
Dr. Forbin would understand.
It's that fucking Hasselein curve, man. Wait, I think that's the curve you take on the Hasselein test. You got the Hasselein curve. I like the flares. I like the lens that they used to get the flares on that. I like that they shot the night stuff at night. It's night for night,
daring.
Not day for night.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
That's
yes.
what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yes, it is daring. The monkey. They call them monkeys. They're not monkeys. They're chimpanzees. And Cornelius.
And actually, you're right. For a low-budget film, the thing to do would be day for night as far as, you know, your money situation. But so at least it did
They've got the HMIs out. I mean, they're lighting that crap out.
So, you know, which again is like because of the lack of money, your lighting looks like lighting.
But what it helps you do is it helps you hide things if it's dark.
Yeah.
That's the converse side.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a great, I've always loved this shot. From behind here, out of focus, and he comes, shows up in that shot from inside the car. I really like Roddy McDowall's performance as Cornelius, and I say this because, in a way, in the Planet of the Apes series, he's more in our minds as Caesar than Cornelius, even though he played both, at least in mine, for some reason. I mean, he played...
Get in.
I know, she's great. But I just find it fascinating how he managed to make them different characters. And I just appreciate it. I like it a lot.
It's one hell of a dashboard to throw that much light on her.
That's my method of lighting. I like lighting from underneath the... I like lighting the insides of cars.
Do you?
I do. It's cool. It's interesting.
She just off-road that.
Yep.
Yeah,
she's in the station wagon.
She's not afraid.
Armando.
Enter Ricardo. Ricardo Montalban. Real Corinthian leather. I always liked Ricardo Montalban.
He's unique.
Yes.
I really liked him. I thought he was awesome.
It was a nice, his career had been in the 50s and 60s in the movies, and he'd moved into television a lot, so there's a good chance for him to get back in the movies, too.
Anyone who wants to watch an excellent old Ricardo Montalban film, it's called Border Incident, I think. Anthony Mann directed it. It's a noir, and Ricardo Montalban is awesome in it. Check it out. I think it's called Border Incident.
I like what he just said. He goes, aren't we rude enough to each other? Do we have to be rude to animals or something like that?
Yeah.
Like,
you know, when's it going to stop?
Yeah, when's it going to stop? And then just another good comment about humanity and how we treat each other and how we treat others and...
That's a mask. That's the worst makeup of this entire film.
That's the worst makeup of this entire film. But that little baby monkey is adorable.
How could they expect us to swallow that?
That little baby monkey's cute. That's real. The babies are real.
Yes, I can definitely see it against the fake mother that they put behind it.
Horribly fake. I don't understand why they couldn't just get like a real gorilla in a cage. Like, how hard is that? It's in a cage. It doesn't even have to do anything.
It might have hurt the little baby. I guess they needed a mother, true mother kid.
Mm-hmm.
God, that's the worst makeup. It looks like Trog, the Joan Crawford movie.
It doesn't talk. Oh. Aw. Aw, Zira. She's so cute.
We're just discussing that the worst makeup is on the mother. Or the
mother gorilla?
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. Okay, so now I didn't see this coming when I first saw this film. I didn't get the plan.
Hmm.
Did you figure it out?
Of the two monkeys?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The two monkey plan?
Yeah.
I don't think I figured it out at this point.
Oh, I had it figured out the second they showed us the baby.
Oh, right here?
Yeah.
You knew that they were going to make the switch?
Yeah. It looks just like the other baby. Aw, Milo.
Little baby.
I was only 10.
I was too. I got it. It was like two little monkeys. They look exactly the same.
Oh, wow. Roddy McDowell had to smoke a cigar through his appliance.
Now, that's a real monkey.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a real monkey.
That's a real monkey.
It's a real adorable little monkey, just like the one in the cage is a cute little
And Kim Hunter's makeup looks pretty good next to it.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it does hold up. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Their makeup's the best.
Yeah.
The two of them. They again, because of all the practice, they work so well with it.
And there's only two of them to do a day.
Yeah.
So they could really elaborate and do it with care on their makeups.
And we know it's important because Eric Braeden's yelling.
He doesn't yell too often.
I know.
If it makes him yell, you know it's some serious stuff. Eric Braeden comes from the less is more camp of acting.
Okay, you see, Bradford Dillman, why didn't you think of that? Now they're going to go looking where they are.
Yep. I love that guy, too. He's like, yeah, I'm smart. It was an accident, but I'll take credit for it.
See, I'm watching this. I'm like, oh, they could have gone to the Everglades. So maybe that can happen. Because, of course, you know, watching it the first time, you have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Oh, they're going to go to the Everglades, and then we'll get the Planet of the Apes in a nice, peaceful kind of way. Because now, you know, definitely now you get with Armando, you get hope.
Interesting. You see your top wig. And then you see the pork chop sideburn appliance that's put on the sides there and combed into the top wig.
I got to say, I really like Paul. Palatine wrote some damn good dialogue. This is when
Bradford Dillman played St. Francis of Assisi.
Oh, anyway. This is when I first found out about Francis. You know, that's how I learned about St. Francis of Assisi. He was from Planet of the Apes.
Well, what do you know?
Well, you know.
Ah, sure you would.
Right. Okay, this is maybe where I had an inkling of, like, well, why is she asking to do that?
Hmm. I'm just having a moment about Milo, Dr. Milo. I can't believe you just killed Milo the gorilla.
Yeah, well, that's the
so
thing.
So ridiculous. It took me all this time for that really to, like,
wow.
Really annoy me.
Yep. Yep. And of course, well, whatever. We talked about the irony of it all.
That's horrible.
That is a different looking baby. It's different looking. That chimpanzee looks different than the other one.
No, they look the same.
No, they look different. You can tell that they're different.
Barely.
I can tell.
They're barely different.
You look in the eyes. The eyes are...
Zira was able to connect with that mother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On it to say, we're switching.
Mm-hmm, probably.
And the mother not to put up a fight.
Yeah.
So that's a very
That's a pretty advanced thing.
That's, you know, when you...
Well, because that's... And what's interesting about that is that's the kind of connection between two living things that has nothing to do with, you know, like an evolved state of mind or being able to speak or whatever. It's actually like an instinctual way of connecting to someone. You know, like to explain to that big gorilla what was going to happen had to be completely done on instinct.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there was no words, but
it's she.
Oh, look at the chimpanzee.
It's cute.
Yeah, they're little terrors, but they're cute. It's a good yeah. If they're swaddled in blankets, they're okay.
He's strapped down under that blanket.
I'm going to give you a quick story about using monkeys on set for Starship Troopers, and I got the story from Trey. So. On Starship Troopers, in the script, you know where there's the whole thing with the ferret? It was supposed to be a monkey. They said, no way, monkey out, ferret in, because you can't train a monkey to do anything like that that a ferret can. Monkey's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult. I mean, legitimately so, they're animals.
Well, and because they're not like dogs where, like, you tell them what to do and they're like, fine, I'll do it just for your attention.
Right, they can't be trained. Yeah,
they
same
can't
way.
Be trained because they want to do their own thing.
Absolutely.
Because they have their own, you know, presence of mind.
Yeah. Wow.
Another night shoot.
I love how he just happens to hit.
It's like, give me my gun. This is some heavy shit, man.
Yeah, it is.
That's right. She had two... kisses with humans in her installments.
And what is he says? And you're my first. And she's like, do you really have to kiss? Okay.
Aww.
Now, do you know in the original Planet of the Apes, actually, for Beneath Planet of the Apes, it was a part of a plan to maybe have an ape-human hybrid.
Hmm.
Which they scrubbed.
Interesting.
For whatever
reason. Way to go. Yeah.
I think that would have been interesting.
Another direction.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not clear as
to
why
this is. It's a little controversial, I guess. You know, interspecies meeting.
Or it's just far, you know, just far away from where they were going with the story and just too hard to integrate, maybe. Or controversial. Who knows?
I think probably it was mostly because of that. I think now maybe you could get away with it a little bit easier.
Yeah, it depends. We don't know.
I mean, thinking of a human having sex with, like, an ape is pretty, I would say, controversial.
Yeah, I would say so. That's why they call it bestiality.
Yep.
Yep. He's like, why are you still talking to me? I'm not interested.
Yeah.
He just walks away in the middle of a sentence. Oh, that's a nice shot through the cage.
Go, Armando.
That's a good, this was a great role for him. I mean, as small as it was, but still. Do you like how he snapped at that map there?
Yeah,
right?
I did.
He's definitely showing his Teutonic background now. Of course, we could expect it. Remember, this is the 70s, and you know, World War II was only 30 years before, barely. So definitely, I think there's a bit of the... it's got to be the German that's the bad guy kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, they're always the bad guy.
That's a nice shot of them against, like, the background of wherever it was, the lights of L.A. in soft focus back there.
Oh, God.
Oh, and they didn't even notice it, too. Wow.
It's their last little bit of beauty.
And they're, you know, it's like they're removed from that culture, even though it's out there.
Roddy McDowall really took this whole franchise to the very end.
He did. He did. But I really like what he did with Cornelius in this film. He really got to do something. And once again, then change it completely, you know, just change it up for Caesar.
Yeah.
Oh, don't drop the bag. Or at least tell Cornelius, Zira. Ugh.
You would think she as smart of a scientist she's been this entire series.
That was kind of lame. She left the forks and the knives.
Yeah.
What happens to the bag?
It gets discovered. That's how they figure out that they're there.
Oh.
I think that's part of it. As my mom would say, oh, look at the old car. Yeah, this is where it gets discovered.
See, I forgot about this.
Yeah, this is what Dan did in Long Beach. He found her driver's license in it. No, I'm just kidding. Oh, it's the helicopters. Oh, he knows where they went. Because he's a smart German scientist.
Bad guy.
He's bad. Now he's bad, bad, bad. How L.A.? The oil derricks?
Mm-hmm.
Wait, we need a medic. She's coming through. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who's this actor that plays Dixon?
Bradford Dillman.
What else is he in?
He was a big character actor in the 60s and 70s, and even the 50s, I think, when he was much, much younger. I think he could, by
besides
the 80s,
besides the two films
done.
I mentioned, didn't he do some, wasn't he part of an ensemble of a military war movie that was really popular?
I remember him from TV, all over TV.
Bradford Dillman was also in The Swarm, I think. Irwin Allen. Oh, wasn't no, Bradford no, Dillman in
we
that?
Don't, we don't talk about The Swarm.
I'm trying to think of films that
if he did, it killed his career. All right, I'm going to the Google.
You need to look him up. I think he's a really good actor, and I think he's very handsome. I'm going to say that about him.
Well, he was, and this is a really good role for him. Yeah. The roles are really good. This is not the type of role he usually had. I mean, he usually was a character actor. He played, like, you know, the lawyer who comes on a show, or you know, a villain or something like that.
But he's really great in this. Like, I don't know. You can tell he clearly sympathizes for them. He really cares. You can tell he's struggling with, like, you know, all these ideas that he never thought he'd have to even really think about.
Yeah. I think this is the biggest film that he did, at least the last one. I think he was in films in the late 50s, early 60s, when he was a little younger. Because already he was getting a little older here.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Do people ever drive on the right side of the road in this movie? No. Answer, no.
I never knew we knew the name of the shipyard.
McKinley and Son. Yeah. Oh, there's the ship. Look at this. Look at where they are. Look where they have to stay. It stinks of man. Wow. Ooh, dissing on oil.
Yeah.
Got a little digging on oil because back then...
Yep.
This is right around the oil crisis.
Yep.
Dishing on the humans. That monkey is cute. He's like, I'm here.
But you guys were just like that too. You know, they met hundreds of humans since they've been there. They trust three. It was the same in their society.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people did they trust there?
Yeah. There was Zira and Cornelius and Lucius. Oh, I can't believe they left Lucius behind.
Lucius gets no love.
Lucius is dead.
Uh-oh.
You know, it doesn't make a difference how many times you watch this film. It's not going to change.
Same ending.
I want it to change. No, don't go in that room. Oh, he's going in that room. That's great photography. For some reason, I'm thinking of Dirty Harry.
Gosh, this guy is such a doucher.
He's a mate. Well, he thinks he's
saving the world.
He's being righteous. He thinks he's saving the world, exactly.
He thinks he's saving the world, and like 3,000 years in the future.
Yeah, it's like the president said, we're all going to be dead then. What are you worrying about?
Who cares? Like, why don't you just try to better yourself now instead of worrying about, because guess what? There is no future.
Yeah, you know, it's like I am fond of saying sometimes, and I will apply this here before the action really kicks up. Life is like fine electronics. You don't want to force the parts, you know. So if there's a situation, you don't want to force it. You have to kind of let it play itself out somewhat. And that's what he's doing. He's pushing the situation and see what happens. He causes the future. It's all his fault. It is.
Aww.
Yeah. I like the pacing. The pacing is really cool. Really cool.
Yeah, this movie, comparative to the last one, actually has really great pacing, I think.
Yeah, much better.
Yeah.
I think there's more to this. There was more in the script. The last one suffered from, there were good parts of the script, but getting from part to part,
mm-hmm.
it depended on action and not enough writing in those action sequences.
Yeah.
And this one is...
themselves known, and it took you out of the film because of it. I don't think you're really taken out of the film in this movie.
This one's tight. This film is tight. And then here, because it can take time, because we know exactly what's going on, it can take its time. I mean, there's definitely suspense now.
Yep, there's suspense.
And it's just quiet, still, and he's just walking around, but...
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Gosh, just barely misses him. Barely.
I like that. I always thought that was cool.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm so sad about this. Cornelius and Zira are better than most people I've ever met in my entire life, and they're mm-hmm. fictional characters, apes from the future.
Wow.
Yep. And here we go. And he kicks it. And I'm remembering the first time I saw this. Wow.
Oh, if only Cornelius would get there sooner.
It's all tragic. It's just tragic, tragic, tragic. And he's just waiting. And there's no music. I love that there's no music.
Yep.
Goldsmith knew when to spot something and when not.
There we go. Oh, and she sees him.
No.
Yeah. And of course.
Say the first word that Aldo said.
Yeah. And here come the choppers. Here comes a great shot from the chopper.
I'm having a hard time talking right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is rather quiet. We've become engrossed in basically this last sequence. Which is actually really well done, and we're just watching. And of course, now here's the interesting thing. Braden, well, Hasline knows that if they come, he can't do what he has to do. So he's got to hide. Because the president said, "I want them alive." And his plan is to kill them. Though he wants to try and take the baby, if anything, and kill the baby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But why is he hiding from the cops then? Why isn't he just...
Baby killer.
I'm kind of confused now. Why is he hiding?
Because
he's not supposed to be there.
He's not supposed to be there, and he wants to kill them.
But then why didn't he shoot Zira when he could have? He could have just shot her dead right there.
I don't know.
It's a fine point
of
logic.
Insanity never makes sense.
True. And then, now comes the siege, and they're gathering. And it's just, here's Cornelius. He's been a pacifist, and, I mean, he suffered through what happened, and it's just amazing the journey. I mean, because we've seen Zira's journey. I keep on getting on Cornelius. I mean, she is more the star than Cornelius is, but he definitely has this arc that's just like, you know, he's always supportive of Zira.
Yeah.
Always.
A good mate.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. She sees Stevie.
Yeah, and this is where you think, like, maybe they're going to get away.
So she's going to try and get out. That's right. That's what it was. And then, oh, man. And so he just wants the baby, right? Well, there you go. Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
It's, of course, Cornelius. That's it.
Yeah, and stop
like,
him.
It's like, you just shot my wife, buddy, and you're falling in the water. And of course, and someone's shooting, and then unfortunately in the movies they'll shoot back.
Oh.
It broke his legs big time.
So what, there's military and cops? Who shot in the military? I think it was the military guys.
The baby.
I think it was the military guys.
Yeah, this would have been rough to have the dogs eat her alive in the original idea.
Yeah. That's because you put guns in everyone's hands. That's what happens.
Oh. Look at that blood is so bad.
This ending was so sad. This ending was
actually
just so
they did
sad.
Well with his legs because yeah. That's the way the dummy landed.
Oh yeah,
so that's decent.
I think they might have shot that a few times to get the legs right. I mean,
I
with
love
the dummy
that.
Landing,
I would have done the same thing, Zira.
This is a great shot pulling back with the helicopter.
Why do you think she threw the baby off so they wouldn't know that it was the wrong baby?
She was basically saying, "Here, take the baby. You wanted the baby. Here's the baby. You dead bastard." Symbolic. All right, I'm sorry. The lighting here did not match what we just had here.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back on the Fox lot.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it's just like you could have tried and matched it.
And now we come up to
I'm giving this the benefit of the doubt up until the very end. I'm just playing it nicely.
With
so here we
taking
go.
The same snippet of footage and going backwards and forwards,
then, okay.
Up pan, down pan, up pan, down pan, up pan. Very haunting ending,
but
though.
It's over. Yeah, exactly.
And
it's
over
black.
The black. And you, yeah. Then
yeah.
You have the credits.
And awesome.
No music, right? Oh no, we have maybe, slight strings are there.
Yeah, strings come in.
Get it, Kim Hunter.
There you go.
She's pretty awesome.
Albert saw me
Kim
and
Hunter's
Jason Evers. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yep. Wow. That ending packs an emotional punch.
It's really good. I forgot how much I like this one.
Yeah,
James Bacon.
They're real journalists. Army Archer, James Bacon.
Yeah.
They had real journalists among the...
You were saying about liking this one?
I guess I forgot how much I really, really like this one, but I really like this film out of the ape films.
Yeah.
It's just... It's really good. It's yeah. Really good all the way through, beginning, middle, end.
Mm-hmm.
I think... doing the flip side of everything is wonderfully entertaining.
Yep.
So I love it because of that. I love it. I'm biased, but I love Jerry Goldsmith's scores, so I always loved it because of that. I love Roddy McDowall and Kim Hunter, and I always loved Eric Braeden. So it's always cool to see them all together.
You know, this is like, I'm going to go right out and say it. This is, to me, it's a better than E.T. story. Because when E.T. came out and like everybody was like, E.T., and I was like a kid and I still never really loved E.T. I liked it, but I didn't love E.T. like other people loved E.T. And kids like that were my... Because I was the same age as like the little kids in that
was
movie.
Was it too sentimental for you? Or?
I don't know. I just never really grabbed onto it the way that other people grabbed onto it. Maybe that's what it was. Maybe it was too sentimental, or maybe there was just things about... I don't know. But I feel like this movie is almost a similar type of a story of E.T. and I like it better.
Wow. Whoa. I like your taste. Let me tell you. That's awesome. Taking E.T. down for this. I mean, this is a dark... I mean, this is much more adult. And my point is, this is a very adult take on that, whereas E.T. was definitely from a mature child's point of view,
right.
Which is what Spielberg's intent
right.
was.
I mean, I still like E.T., but I don't know why. I just never connected with it the way other people did.
Hmm.
And I could have sat down and watched E.T. right now, and I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it as much as I just enjoyed Escape from the Planet.
Well, because this definitely tested the limits of what it's like to be a true alien or clashing culture and challenging the culture.
Maybe it's E.T. himself.
E.T. has no
problem. Like, because this has real good characters. Like, I love Zira and Cornelius.
Right.
Like, I just love them. And maybe that's part of it. I don't know.
Well, you didn't find anyone to love in E.T. They didn't hit you the same way.
Well, I don't love E.T.
But E.T. has no person. E.T.'s an alien, cute, and everything, but you never have a conversation with E.T., which, okay, is quite a challenge.
Yeah, like, Spielberg actually. Like, persecution and stuff, and then people want to. I mean, it's very similar the way like the government and like mankind like approach E.T. is the way that they do with these apes.
Yeah,
come from space.
Yeah, but I think E.T. was a little different in the sense that E.T. became a vessel, essentially a man. Well, okay, I'm just going to go out there and say it became a manifestation of Elliot's alienation in a way. I mean, story-wise. And so that's why he would stay a cipher, because it was really about Elliot and Elliot helping out his alienation so he could
And maybe that's why I didn't really care so much about it when I was a kid, because I never felt alienated. I felt awesome.
Well, good for you. That's a rarity.
There you go. Yes.
That's a rarity.
You are unique.
That's why the rest of the world fell in love with E.T. and you didn't.
And I was sitting around watching a Planet of the Apes marathon.
You're in the minority on that one for kids growing up.
Wow.
I mean, I still like E.T. Don't get me wrong.
Do you like it with the walkies or with the guns?
Oh, guns. Oh, of course
it's got to be the shotguns. Come on. Wow, this movie, it still packs a punch, holds up, except for that last little part with the little ape.
Backwards, forwards.
Oh, yeah,
What were they thinking?
Yeah. That's bad. But the ending is good.
Between the original gorilla and the zoo.
Yeah, and also the other chimpanzee suit, which they kept far away from us as far as possible.
But it was still horrible. That could have been in China. That's how bad it was.
That's budgetary issues, but as far as structure and screenplay and where do we take the franchise from here after Beneath, wow. I mean, watching these as we are right now, it just reaffirms they were onto something good.
They were, and Paul Dean, I mean, obviously working with the whole production team, and Paul Dean definitely, obviously had a huge hand in shaping these, and the dialogue did really a superb job of just laying everything down from the plot-wise and the ideas to essentially the dialogue. I love a lot of the dialogue in there.
Yeah.
I mean, going back to Beneath, with all the liturgy stuff, all the religious stuff, from the two different cultures, but even stuff here that Cornelius talks about and stuff that Hessline talks about. I'd like to look at the screenplay again or transcript and read that, because it really is a literary quality to it somewhat, which I found really interesting.
I'd like to research the drafts that led up to this. I'll bet that would be fascinating. Mm-hmm. The ideas that they went off on, tangents.
Yeah, and didn't develop
for whatever reason.
For like Dr. Milo. Why did they have Dr. What was the whole story? Because it seems like they started and then we're going to go in a different direction just for whatever reasons. It seemed kind of weird. It's like a weird appendage.
Well, it's like they kind of had to have Dr. Milo in order to explain how they figured out how to fly the spacecraft. Because that's what they used. It was like that Dr. Milo was smart in that kind of way, and he's the one who fixed up the spacecraft.
Rather than Cornelius and Zira went off with him, did his whole spaceship by themselves.
And I'm totally with you there, but then to just lose him.
Right.
And
in such an insanely stupid way.
15 minutes
in.
The fact that
he was strangled by that gorilla. I mean, I wish he would have just been shot, for God's sake. Like, I wish someone would have just shot him.
Something bad and really just, yeah, exactly.
Well, because it was it just seems so ridiculous that these chimpanzees from this really elevated, primate society one of them would have been killed by like a modern day gorilla.
It was because
he was leaning against a cage.
Well, he's talking and they talk, and then he turned around and then he got too close and he got grabbed and oh please. Yeah, exactly.
It's the whole thing is like this is ridiculous. I would have rather have had him get shot. It just would have made for a much more exciting.
That was very lazy writing.
Well, then that goes back to the writing. There's a point where they didn't fill that in.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, we need to get out of this. Okay, that's how we're going to get out of this. And it may have been they had more complex, thing like Zira being eaten by the dogs.
Right.
Which I think they solved more elegantly there.
That would have been a horrible ending.
It would have been awful. It was just like, there would have been too much.
This movie would have ended that way.
You don't like a movie where the heroine
gets... totally gone above this.
You have a resistance to movies where the heroine gets eaten alive by dogs at the end? What's with you?
Yeah, I'm not really into that.
Well, I'll teach their own. Okay, I'm just saying.
Actually, now I want to talk about Dr. Hasslein really briefly. I think he was really well set up on it, but I'm like thinking about it now. Once things got going, whatever was built up in terms of growing interest in terms of Hasslein and where he's going
became one dimensional.
It became one dimensional. Mm-hmm. It just once he started shouting, you know, I'm the German,
which is why he's a bad guy and not a villain. There's a difference. He's just a bad guy.
Right. I would have liked for it to continue more. Maybe that stuff was edited out. I don't know.
He became underwritten.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. He became underrepresented in the film. There.
Because I mean, it serves a purpose. See him, like he had his little purpose like earlier on when she was talking about, but it just didn't seem like that drove him very much as the film.
Once the interrogation, once the interrogation started, and then he said, "Well, I have to do this," and then it was getting one dimensional. And then when it got to the president, right. And then really got one dimensional.
Right. Right. And he just didn't seem to care so much about what he was doing, but yet he was doing it anyway.
And that's why I think maybe some stuff got cut out, for why he was hiding from the cops. I mean, maybe there was another phone call that said, don't do this or else we're going to arrest you. We definitely have to blah, blah, blah.
I think we were shortchanged of his intellect as the film went on because he wasn't operating on many levels and being as depth for his intellect as he could have been in the way I was seeing him.
Right, yeah.
He should have been processing much more entertaining things for us to watch him do.
Yeah. But who is necessary object. So we don't know, making a film is like making sausage. You don't want to know how it happens. There's many different paths to it. You know, you got the script and you have got production, you got editing.
I actually want to learn how to stuff sausage. Side note, I'm going to do that one day.
You're going to learn how to stuff sausage? Man. Well, that's true.
You just have to have a meat grinder.
Is that code?
Well, that's... yes and no.
Okay.
Stuffing a sausage is just like making a movie. First, you have a meat grinder.
Yes.
Right?
Then you have to get the meat, and then you shove
throw
it
a bunch of shit in there, in the top.
And then you got to put it in there. Then you got to group it all together, and you got to get the pork casings. Yep. And you have to have a machine that actually puts it into the pork casings. And
yeah,
we're stretching.
But what goes into the
metaphor.
Meat grinder? No one knows. Is I think what you were trying to say.
Well, you put in your choice meat, and then obviously and no all one, sorts of other things go in there.
No one cares if the presentation is dazzling enough.
Right.
We're beating this metaphor up to bloody pulp, but it is a.
I don't know. You're the one who started talking about sausages, and you know how I feel about that.
I said, so.
just took me off track.
All right. Okay. Let's see. Rachel Portman's score was awesome.
Yes, she hit another one out of the park, don't you think?
Actually, I think Jerry Goldsmith's score was interesting. I liked some parts. The 70s parts kind of wear on me a little bit now.
Yeah,
like,
well,
a little twangy, kind of the guitar.
It dates itself.
Some parts date itself. I mean, it's appropriate. Like, most, like, the main theme was really, really cool. And
his score for the first one, Planet of the Apes, does not date. Yeah. That is a... iconic score.
And the challenge actually with this film is that it was set in modern time, which now is not modern time anymore. It's back 40 years ago. So
it's still pretty modern though. You know.
Yeah. I mean, you can still buy it. It's the kind of thing. It's interesting watching films like that. So
Yeah.
Oh. Still like it.
Still a big shout out for the makeup team and the wardrobe.
That was Dan Strypeek again, yeah. And I can't get on the internet, so I can't tell you who did the costumes, but they did a good job.
And they were thrilled only to have three as compared to banks and banks of people.
That's
that
right.
Had to...
And the makeup looked great. It just looked great. I think it actually looked even better in this film because you get a lot of comparison. You see a lot more people, and then you get the comparison of the horrible gorillas, but also like seeing the real chimpanzee babies and how well they look. You know,
Kim Hunter looked really good against them.
Yeah,
baby.
She looked really great with that
she
baby.
Great.
And that, I mean, that's a real chimp.
And the production challenge, actually, with this is that they were in much more of this film than they were in the first two, well, especially the second film, but the first film, they were in a lot of it. But here, they were in practically, I'd say, almost every scene except the court scene. Some
and
of
they just,
scenes.
And they showed they can hold a feature. I mean, these are, you know, these actors and these characters, they can hold their own film.
This was Kim Hunter's, I think, last big film.
I think as far as popular most
film.
Popular, would think so. I can't think of what would be after that.
Because she, you know, I mean, she of course won an Academy Award for Streetcar, right?
I couldn't tell you if she won the Oscar for that or not.
I think she did.
For supporting?
Yeah.
Hmm.
She played Stella.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Also, if you want to see a wonderful Kim Hunter movie.
Yes.
It's a Michael Powell, Emmerich Pressburger film called, the original title is A Matter of Life and Death. Mm-hmm. It's a British film. When it came over to America, they changed the title to Stairway to Heaven. It's a film that stars David Niven and Kim Hunter. Heidi, you should watch that movie if you haven't seen it. It's marvelous, and it's a really romantic, intellectually challenging film. And Kim Hunter, it's like 1945, and you see her in her youth, you know, and the Technicolor is awesome. But anyone wants to see a wonderful Kim Hunter film that you may not have heard of, A Matter of Life and Death, it just came out on DVD, a remastered version. Wonderful. I recommend
it. Oh, I would love to check that out.
Okay.
Kim Hunter was beautiful in it.
Yeah.
And her part is very sympathetic, and she plays it very, very well. And the screenplay is just fantastic stuff, goes on. So anyway.
Yeah. No, I mean, and actually, this gets back to what we were talking about earlier. I really think this is more Zira's film.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and
Cornelius,
but it's Zira and Cornelius.
Yeah.
And definitely, she is.
Maybe that's why I like it so much.
Yeah.
But Roddy McDowell has his coming up.
Oh, he inherits it from there. But if we will have to now watch Conquest. Which of course, we're watching Conquest. And there it changes because now he plays his son. But if you watch it, he's in Conquest, but he doesn't have a lot to do, even though he does quite a bit. It's only in battle that really you see his personality all come together and have to deal with lots of things. So, and that has to do with the nature of how Conquest, you know, is constructed as a film. But we have to get the Conquest on that.
So there's five total?
Yes. And we've just completed, we're about to complete in just a few seconds.
Number three.
So on that note, I think we've pretty much grokked Escape from the Planet of the Apes about as much as we could. I think it still holds up all these years later, which is awesome. So
it's been grokked.
Again, I will say it's one of the most solid franchises, you know, as far as what they did and where they took this idea.
So.
From A to Z, so
wow.
Go ape, everyone.
Woo. Ooh, go ape. All right, and so this has been
Tim McMillan
and
Heidi Hilliker
and Serge Delpierre, and this has been Film Grok. See you next time.